End zone. Got Dell again. His third of the night. This guy is a touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby. Yes!
Welcome to Scott Bowl Podcast. We have reached a true critical mass tonight in terms of things we have to talk about in the world of Houston Cougars sports. A couple teams just saw their season end, a couple more looking ahead to the real critical stretch of their 2023 season. We have some recruiting to talk about, some Cougar alums in the professional ranks as well. It's a veritable buffet, a collection, a jumble, a smorgasbord, whatever noun you'd use to describe the Cougar topics we had to talk about tonight. Certainly our medias episode in a bit. Dustin, my friend and co-host, I always ask you if some variation of how you're doing, or which is kind of darkly funny because we haven't had the best year outside of the podcast. So I'll change it up a bit, Dustin. Working hard or hardly working?
I'm going to say hardly working, if only because yesterday I had a 6-hour teleconference learning session to how to do my job that I'd already been doing for 3 months, and it was a lot of being retaught how to do the thing I was already doing while I couldn't do any of those things, and so all my work was stacking up because I was having it explained to me how to do it. So that felt like I was hardly working, but I'm going to be working hard trying to catch up from all the hardly working that I did sitting on that 6-hour teleconference recently.
We love it. Got to mention here at the top, we are proud members of the 1012 Network, a podcast network covering all things Big 12 conference sports over there. A conference that, as we sit here tonight, the Cougars are less than 2 months away from joining. Please do follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Please listen and subscribe to the 1012 podcast wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And of course, please also consider supporting our podcast by becoming a patron at patreon.com/shpawdcast, where you won't just be supporting the ongoing time and energy Dustin and I put into this weekly podcast, but you will also get access to our collection of premium episodes, including a couple ones we did recently that I am proud of. We did a detailed look, you, me, and Bobby, at the Alton McCaskill Jr. transfer, what that transfer means in the big picture and little picture of Cougar football, featuring the two of us and Bobby kind of talking about the transfer itself, but also what we think that means about the program. Does this program have a culture problem, et cetera, et cetera? I thought it was really good. And we also did a solo look by yours truly at four intriguing, as of recording, still uncommitted big men who Cougar men's basketball could potentially use its last scholarship on. So those and all other premium episodes and supporting the show for as little as 16 cents a day, $5 a month, you can get access and receive our undying gratitude. And of course, it wouldn't be an intro to the show if I didn't mention our good friends at the good brand Home Field Apparel on the series of tubes that make up the World Wide Web at homefieldapparel.com. Since I guess every podcast can be someone's first, Home Field is an Indianapolis-based apparel company that makes vintage t-shirts and other wearables that are incredibly comfortable, have awesome vintage logos spanning hundreds of schools with those unique vintage designs that you're really not going to find anywhere else. They have a great U of H collection. I just recently blessed myself by ordering a couple shirts that previously had been out of stock at my size as a larger gentleman who maybe doesn't fit into these medium t-shirt designs. And Dustin, it was so fantastic to come home today to a couple of fresh new Cougar tees. And I also treated myself to a UC Irvine Zot crew neck when I got home from work earlier today. And listener, if you're thinking that you'd like some vintage tees for your Cougar collection, but maybe you want to save a little dough, we got you. Just go to homefieldapparel.com, enter our promo code HOLMAN12, that's HOLMAN12 at checkout. That promo code is going to save you 15% off your first order. You won't regret it. You'll save a little money and you'll look like $1 million. So that's homefieldapparel.com, promo code HOLMAN12. Save some money and look good repping your Cougs with some fantastic, unique vintage designs. So as always, we're going to lead off our show in the sports section tonight with a Cougar sport that's participating in the NCAA championship for their sport, the Cougar women's golf team, who capped off, I would say, what was a really encouraging season with a young squad in the regionals up in the beauty of far southeast Washington. I would say, before we get into the specifics, Dustin, a very encouraging season. A team clearly pointed in the right direction, I think I would say.
Yeah, I mean, the same mind as you. It was, you know, they didn't advance, so it was, you know, the kind of, you fell short of the ultimate goal there, but I think all in all, you'd have to be proud with the way the season went, and they certainly gave a strong account of themselves. You listeners may remember the Cougs were given a 7 seed in the Pullman Regional with the top 5 teams. Out of the 12-team field advancing to Nationals. And, you know, after round one, it looked like Houston might be right in there. They were in 6th place, just 1 stroke in 1 spot out of the top 5. However, round two was kind of tough to the Cougs, dropped them back to 8th place, where they would end up finishing. After all 3 rounds were complete, they ended up finishing 7 strokes under par, good for that 8th place. 8th place finish. We're 12 strokes back of the cut line for the top 5 there. And, you know, the killer thing is, it's kind of like I said, it was really just that second round that the did Houston in. They shot 284 as the team in the opening round. That jumped all the way to 292 in round 2 and then back to 281 in round 3. And it looked like the other team's, you know, scores were more kind of evenly distributed. So I don't think it was just a weather and day 2 thing or anything like that. And, you know, had Houston shot a similar round in round 2 to what they did in round 1 or round 3, that had been right there, you know, to make the cut to potentially go to Nationals. It would have been right in the mix at the very least. You know, ultimately the finish where they did. And, you know, for the most part, it was a pretty chalky regional. You saw the number 1 nationally ranked Stanford finish way ahead of everybody else at a ridiculous 50 under par. Number 1 ranked individual Rose Zhang of Stanford won the individual title. And then other than 10 seed Sacramento State making a surprisingly game effort of it and finishing 2 strokes ahead of U of H in 7th place, everybody else that finished ahead of U of H was seated higher than them, and everyone that they finished ahead of, you know, was ranked lower than them. The 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 teams advanced to Nationals. So, you know, overall, you know, I don't think you could say it was Houston's best effort of the year or best performance of the year, but not a bad effort either. And like I said, it's easy to not get too upset about Houston not doing better, because it feels like they were well ahead of schedule, given that, you know, 3 of their tournament 5 golfers this year were freshmen, and 4 of 5, you know, have eligibility to come back next year. And, you know, it is notable. I do want to mention the one individual who isn't coming back is a super senior, Annie Kim, who went out with a bang, shot a opening round 66, which was run 1 stroke off the school record for lowest round in the NCAA postseason. She would finish 6 under par, good for a tie for 13th place on the individual leaderboard, the low scorer for the Cougs. So yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it was a strong performance, not maybe their best performance of the year, not maybe the ceiling of what they're capable of, but kind of like you said, it's easy to not get too worked up when you go, okay, yeah, this is, you know, A, you just got back to the NCAA postseason, which, kind of like you mentioned, no postseason, you know, for a program that was going just every single year, all of a sudden COVID cancels the 2020, you know, kind of like you mentioned, some natural and some human forces combining to not let Houston compete in 2021 despite qualifying, and then for the first time just not qualifying as a team last year. So good to see this team just competing at all, and like I said, giving a solid account of themselves, and you know, I think giving us positive vibes and positive things to build on for the future.
And that was kind of the general story of the 3 days at the Palouse Ridge Golf Club. Those strong first and third day rounds, where you had kind of a not so great day 2 round in the cold and the rain sandwiched in between there, which kept the Cougs really from being super close to pushing for that top 5 finish at the end yesterday. And I think really the Cougars did a good job on day 3. I don't want to understate that in terms of making this competitive, in terms of going into the back nine on Wednesday, giving themselves as much of a shot as they realistically could. But if you're talking about even an even par round in that day 2 round sandwiched in there, I think you're a lot closer to 4 or 5 strokes off your competitors than where you were, which was, I think, closer to 9 or 10 in reality. But that's golf, a very volatile sport. You had that, I think, really strong start, largely on the strength of Annie Kim's incredible day 1 round. Like you said, the second lowest NCAA regional round in program history, good for 6 under par. But maybe in real time, kind of an indicator that, hey, this is going to be tough. You have Annie Kim playing her maybe best round of golf in her fairly lengthy career, and that you were still on the outside looking in at the top 5, but really good showing. Monday's round was also the first time in Cougar women's golf program history that, as a team, the Cougs shot under par for a full round. Tough day. Tuesday, like we said, had the cold front move in kind of the tail end of Monday's round. You actually saw a brief weather delay for the Cougars finishing up Monday, and you dropped to sixth place after day one to tie for eighth on day two. And again, did make things interesting on that final day. Broke the previous postseason low round with a 7-under par on the final day. Really, everybody was shooting really low rounds, or just about everybody. I think Green Bay was 55 over par for a 105-point margin between the top and last place team in the regional. But unfortunately, just outside of getting those top five NCAA championship places, ultimately finishing 12 strokes back of Texas Tech, who took that fifth and final team qualifying spot for the next round. But you're not like singling individuals out, but it hurts that Nicole Abelard won your tournament five with 16 over par, but she was also someone who was top three in the average scoring this year. So I think you kind of just chalked it up to golf being an incredibly volatile sport event to event. And I'd say just a really encouraging second season of Lydia Gum leading the Cougar Women's Golf Program, the kind of step forward this year that I think you and I were hoping for before the season.
Yeah, definitely a really nice bounce back year, one that I think the program and the head coach kind of needed. And I think if we had seen a bounce back like this year, you know, next year, I think that would have been more on schedule given, like I said, the three freshmen playing the significant roles this year. But, you know, really like what we saw, I think the million-dollar question, of course, now becomes, you know, can Houston hold on to, ideally, you know, all three of your freshmen plus, you know, Nicole Abelard heading into next season? And then if so, you know, then the follow becomes, you know, who can you add? Does Gum have another college-ready freshman or two coming in next year? Does she hit the portal like she did to bring in, you know, like Houston did to bring in Abelard? Do you even bring in two newcomers and recruit over somebody? Or does she feel comfortable filling Annie Kim's spot in the tournament five with one of the youngsters who have been in the program for a couple of years, you know, Anna Kahneman or Brooke Morales? So, you know, certainly there are questions to be answered heading into next year, but, you know, given what we saw from the team this year, bouncing back with a really young nucleus, I think the foundation of this program feels strong heading into the Big 12 next year. And I'm excited to see this group compete against Big 12 competition. There are a bunch of strong Big 12 teams. Houston won't be the favorite next year in the Big 12 by any stretch, but, you know, the conference has never produced a national champion in women's golf. They have nobody in the top 10 right now. This is not a, you know, maybe women's basketball or softball type of situation where you're going to have multiple teams that are just in a different stratosphere fear than where Houston is right now. I think this is a conference that Houston can come in, and if they're able to hold on to everybody and maybe add an impact golfer for next year, I think Houston can compete near the top of this conference. So very excited. Probably not an outlook I would have had nearly as rosy a year ago at this time. But like I said, overall, very pleased with how the year went.
And you're losing Annie Kim, but like you said, returning the three golfers who had the lowest average round score, Savince Guild, Abelard, and St. Germain in that order. Also, Alexis Aldana, whose average score was just fractionally higher than the graduating Kim. I think without speaking for you, this is what we wanted to see, Dustin, a noticeable improvement and indication that there are younger athletes to build around.
All right, and sticking with golf, do want to mention that the men are headed to the Auburn Regional this coming week. I believe starts on Monday. The Cougs, of course, won the American Athletic Conference title and earned the automatic bid to what is their third straight NCAA regional appearance. Houston got a 9 seed in the Auburn Regional. And just like we mentioned with the women's tournament, the top 5 seeds will advance to NCAA championships. And just like happened with the Cougar women, actually, Houston gets to compete in the same regional as the national number one ranked team. In this case, that would be Vanderbilt. Other notable teams in the Auburn Regional include number 2 seed Tennessee, 3 seed is the host Auburn, 4 seed Colorado State, 7 seed is TCU, the one Big 12 competition for the Cougs here, and then did want to mention the 12 seed out of the Southland Conference, Augusta University, located, of course, in Augusta, Georgia, which is, shockingly enough, a Division I school in golf and golf only. I can't imagine where they got the idea to do that, but that is going to be a kind of a fun opponent for Houston. And then, yeah, I think in terms of, you know, the outlook, you know, we saw in AAC championships that Houston got really, really strong performances from Santiago de la Fuente and Austin Riley, and they're going to need a repeat of that, and I think they're going to need at least one or two other guys to step up and have a strong tournament if they're going to, you know, have any chance of pulling some upsets and surprising some people. But, you know, I feel like the potential is there, but it is going to kind of take a, you know, everything kind of going right for Houston.
Would say so, certainly, especially with those really good teams kind of in the top seeds of this tournament. Getting into that top five is going to be no easy feat. Quick reminder, last year, the Cougars finished 12th in the Stockton, California Regional, a decent amount off the top five scores they needed, though I believe had a good first day in last year's tournament. So I think, like the women's golf team, the goal here is to be competitive, make the 3 days interesting, be enough in the picture after the first round or two that you don't already, kind of, if you're us, start putting your thoughts together for the season in the postmortem. And I think having Santiago de la Fuente this season, with all respect to last year's group, which was good enough to be an NCAA regional team, Alexander Francis and all of them, I think having a golfer like de la Fuente, who's been the best you've had in this program in the last 5 or 6 years, that makes a big difference. I think that maybe raises your ceiling a bit, but it's obviously going to take a lot more than de la Fuente. And I think also, kind of to go back to the women, it also takes your tournament five having a higher floor than maybe your worst scoring golfer being in that plus 16, 17 range. You know, keep the team score down a bit.
All right. And then speaking of teams that have just ended their seasons recently, we talked about Cougar Women's Golf, but not the only team to see their season come to a close just this morning as we are recording this on Thursday evening, May the 11th. We saw Cougar Softball's season end at AAC Championships in the first round. And yeah, we've seen a handful of softball games. In fact, since our last episode a week and a half ago, we saw the Cougs lose 9-3 to a top 25 Texas A&M team in the midweek. Saw them split two games at home with USF, including getting no hit on senior day before having the rubber match of that series canceled to due to inclement weather. And then the game that we're probably going to spend the most time talking about in depth, losing, as mentioned, 3-2 to Tulsa in the opening round of the AAC tournament, thereby ending their season, Sam. But before we get into that game, I know you had at least some notes on the last couple of games that have taken place. So what was kind of your outlook on the last few run-up games to end the regular season?
Yeah, I'll do a quick rundown there. The Cougs started last Wednesday hosting a top 25 Texas A&M team for the annual strikeout breast cancer game. Kenna Wilkie rested for this one, I guess resting her before a big final regular season weekend series against USF, but not having Wilkie kind of guaranteed the outcome here. Taylor Edwards, your starting pitcher, was tagged for four runs. She did not make it out of the second inning. Celine Flores didn't fare a whole lot better in relief. Eventually, Hannah Boinko settled things down a bit with 3 2/3 of one run ball to finish this off, but kind of worth noting by then, the Aggies had a comfortable lead. Cougars did at one point cut it to 4-2 thanks to Bree Cantu and Brittany Shaw RBI hits the third, but in the next half inning, A&M hit a grand slam, kind of functionally put this game away. The Cougars would ultimately drop this one 9-3. Friday's opener saw the Cougars in an early hole. USF was able to get to a 2-0 lead after the first couple innings, but I did think Kenna Wilkie did a good job limiting the damage with runners on base. Worked behind some poor defense behind her too. Cougars tied it up in the third. Bulls would briefly retake the lead in the fourth, but Cougs would tie it in the sixth inning. Ultimately, sent this one to extras. Extra frames did produce plenty of drama. Both teams stranded multiple runners on a base in a scoreless eighth inning. Bulls would take a lead in the top of the ninth. Were able to get a more Megan Piero leadoff walk. Would get her home via sac fly, but Cougars would walk this one off, I kid you not, on back-to-back wild pitches at different points by USF. Brooke Lorenzo would ultimately score the winning run on the second wild pitch of the inning after previously advancing a scoring position on that wild pitch that scored Holsey to tie the game up in the ninth. This was the Cougs' first head-to-head win against USF after four straight losses and only the second total in the last five seasons where a conference schedule of some kind was played. Unfortunately, not having Wilkie on Saturday maybe doomed the Cougars a bit. Cougs would ultimately lose 8-0 in what ended up being the final regular season game. This one was ultimately run ruled after five innings played. And I guess you could look at this and say, yeah, the non-Wilkie pitching was an issue once again, allowing eight runs in five innings. Really not good there. And that's been a well harped upon topic by us whenever we come and talk Cougar softball on the show. But I guess worth noting that the Cougar lineup was held hitless in the game for the second straight weekend, even if it was an abbreviated five inning game. That's not good, with all respect to the UCF and USF pitchers that were responsible for these perfect games / no-hitters. Just very frustrating. And again, no, this was a shortened game, but this is way too good of a Cougar lineup to have gone missing like this these last 2 weekends, and really missing as often as it did at times this year. Wanted to mention real quickly, though, you did have two Cougars on the first team all-conference, Bree Cantu and Tariah Coleman. Well-earned on both counts. Coleman bagged his 400 for the year, and Cantu hitting an absurd 470 in conference play. Deserving selections for both of those ladies.
All right, so yeah, that takes us up to the conference tournament. Houston with that final game in conference play getting canceled, finished 7-10 in conference play, which got them the 5 seed in the tournament, fifth out of 7 teams. And then first round this morning in a single elimination tournament faced Tulsa, who went 9-9 in conference play for the 4 seed, including, of course, a 3-game sweep of the Cougs. And despite the fact that, you know, neither pitcher really missed any bats in this game, I watched it this morning, there was only one total strikeout in the game between both teams. But yet this still played out as a pitcher's duel. It was 0-0 going into the bottom of the fifth. That's when Tulsa finally struck first, manufacturing a run on a hit batter, a walk, a sack bunt, and a sack fly. But Houston responded immediately, finally getting on the board in the top of the sixth. Kind of a deja vu situation. They opened the inning with a walk, a hit batter, a sack bunt. And then finally they diverged their path. Bailey Myers drew a walk to load the bases with one out. And then Janiah Thomas hits a sharp grounder to second. The throw comes home for the force out, but was badly overthrown, allowing Tariq Coleman to score and tie the game. And then Thomas, I think maybe intentionally, actually got caught up in a pickle between first and second base, which created enough of a diversion that pinch runner Bella Farina was able to scamper home as well, giving Houston a 2-1 lead all on one wild play. But unfortunately, Houston's lead didn't last much longer than Tulsa's did, as the Golden Hurricane quickly tied it up in the bottom of the sixth with a leadoff double and then a bunt and a Houston throwing error down to first to tie the game. And then the frustrating end of the season, one that I imagine Kristen Vesely and many of her players will be kind of replaying in their heads for a while to come this offseason. Tie game 2-2 going into the bottom of the seventh. Tulsa leads off with a single. They try to bunt her to second, but the batter falls behind 0-2. And on that 0-2 count, in between pitches with the Cougar defense napping, the runner just takes second unchallenged for a, like, between pitches stolen base. The Tulsa hitter, who was down 0-2, did make an out, but it didn't really matter because the runner had already advanced herself on her own, and that meant that when the next Tulsa hitter knocked a single through the right side, instead of making it first and second with one out, it was a walk-off winner that ended Houston's season. And, you know, as a final game of the season, it was kind of... fairly fitting. I thought there were some things to like. The team didn't show a lack of effort. Kenna Wilkie battled on the mound despite not having her best stuff and going up against a team that had already faced her twice. Paige Holsey made some incredible plays in center field to keep this one close for as long as it was. But, you know, despite some of the things to like, you know, you saw Bree Cantu and Tariq Coleman, kind of like you talked about, that your two all-conference players, by far your two best position players this year. They got on base a combined 5 times, and then the other 7 spots in the order got on base a combined 4 times between them. And, you know, doesn't mean that's a good way to not score enough runs, and ultimately Houston just ended up making too many mistakes, most notably, you know, forgetting about the runner at the bottom of the seventh with your season hanging in the balance. So, you know, that combined with kind of like we've mentioned and probably like we're going to talk about more here in a little bit, the overall disappointing in nature of the season, including going 0-4 against a very mediocre Tulsa team, kind of makes the whole thing a bitter pill to swallow, Sam.
Yeah, a really frustrating way to end the season because you really almost couldn't have scripted a closer softball game. You saw Kenna Wilkie, I thought, do a good job early in this one, working around some traffic, keeping the game scoreless. You didn't see either team get on the board until Tulsa did in the bottom of the fifth there. Really also, can't overstate what a spectacular catch Paige Holsey made in center field to get the third out to end that fifth inning and keep Tulsa from extending their lead to multiple runs. I thought really just it's been a spectacular year for both bat and ball sports and big defensive plays in center field. It just really frustrating to see what led to the Cougars losing this one. That sequence that you described there, where it just really felt like the Cougar infield defense got kind of caught off guard by Tulsa's Mackenzie Denson stealing a base between pitches. And Bree Cantu and Tariq Coleman both, I think, doing some good stuff today. But like you said, the entire rest of the lineup combining to only reach base 4 times, combining, I think, an even uglier stat to go 1-for-18 in their at-bats today. That's just not good enough. And I think really this game was a neat summary of the season in that you saw Kenna Wilkie be good, but maybe not have her best stuff and not be so spectacular to make up for other areas where I think the Cougs are clearly lacking. And you saw some defensive miscues. You saw also jaw-dropping defensive ability. You certainly saw a team playing its hardest, but just kind of a bitter way to end the season. And I think it's frustrating because I don't think it's U of H's softball birthright to be a top 25 regional host every year kind of team. I think I'm realistic about my expectations, but I would say on the flip side, this also isn't a resource-starved program. You're located in a city, you're located in a state more broadly that produces a lot of Division I softball talent, and transferring now never being easier, you also have the ability to get good local players back to play with you from the transfer portal, like Tariah Coleman and Bree Cantu, two really good Houston prospects who started their college careers at other Big 12 programs. And I don't know if I necessarily expect U of H to make a change because, quite frankly, this athletic director hasn't shown much of an interest in showing his face, I guess figuratively and literally, when a program struggles. But I'm not sure if Coach Vess has shown the ability to build a roster capable of even being a bubble NCAA tournament team, because that was my expectation this year, not the pie-in-the-sky top 25 stuff. My expectation this year was finally, in this last year playing against American Athletic Conference softball opponents, to finally be closer to that Wichita State directional Florida school tier of the conference, to be at least top 65, top 70-ish in the RPI. And instead, you finished 10 games below 500 with a losing record in conference play for the third time in a row and outside the national top 100 in the RPI pretty comfortably. Right now, if you put U of H in the Big 12, you'd be dead last in the RPI by almost 40 spots behind Iowa State. And that number, in reality, is actually probably bigger because Iowa State won a big game earlier today against Baylor. So I don't know. It's kind of a really frustrating place to be.
Yeah, no, it's tough to be optimistic. You just saw this team complete a third straight season with a losing conference record. This program, whose first season was 2001, had only had two seasons with losing conference records prior to doing three in a row. So definitely kind of tough to watch a program that had been basically started strong and continued to be strong now really have its worst stretch of play in program history, I think you'd have to say. And kind of like we've kind of danced around it, but I think you can kind of neatly sum up the disappointment of the season in one sentence, which is that Tariah Coleman, Bree Cantu, and Kenna Wilkie were everything we hoped that they could be this year, and nobody else really looks ready to be a contributor on a Big 12 team. You know, maybe you say Paige Holsey and or Brooke Lorenzo, the glove makes up for the bat being kind of so-so, but ultimately you got to have more than two sticks in the lineup. And, you know, the fact that kind of the first thing I had in my notes was talking about how nobody besides Coleman or Cantu really consistently hit well maybe obscures the fact that Houston was much better at scoring runs than they were at preventing opponents from doing so, because even more dramatically than with the lineup was the drop-off between Kenna Wilkie and the rest of the pitching staff. Kenna Wilkie had a really good year. 2.61 ERA, 167 strikeouts to 66 walks. Houston gave four other pitchers 20 innings on the year or more. They all had ERAs that spanned from 5.47 to 9.48. Between walks and hit batters, they issued 125 free passes in 150 innings with just 82 strikeouts. And to have a chance to even be kind of good in softball, you have to have at least two pitchers who can put up an ERA that, you know, at least like in the low threes, if not sub three. You know, when Houston made the regionals in 2018 and 2019 under Vesely, they had three such pitchers in Savannah Huebner, Presley Bell, and Tristan Melanson. And in the three full seasons since then, not counting the 2020 season, they've only gotten two such seasons from a single pitcher. Hannah Todd is a grad student in her final year of eligibility last year. Kenna Wilkie is a grad student in her final year of eligibility this year. And what we've frankly seen, to be completely, you know, flatly honest, is a inability to attract enough pitching talent and an inability to develop the arms that you have on the staff. And I'm not going to be mean and name names here, but the staff brought back four pitchers from last year's staff who were not named Kenna Wilkie. Two got slightly better, but still weren't really serviceable. One got much worse, and one didn't appear in any games. So, you know, if the staff is retained next year, you know, I will say with the lineup, you know, I can imagine a scenario in which they hold on to Coleman and Cantu. Maybe you find, kind of like they did this year, maybe you go and you find two hitters in the portal, and then you've got, you know, a couple of, like I said, strong glove players that maybe hit a little bit better and hit kind of at least passingly. And I think the number of steps that you need to find to get to a respectable lineup, I think, isn't that many. But it's maybe harder to imagine them either bringing in two strong pitchers from outside the program or developing two strong pitchers from within the program, or, you know, one of each, just because they've struggled so mightily to do either of those things for the last 4 years.
I really hope next season proves me wrong, but I'm having a hard time seeing this be an NCAA caliber team or close to it in 2024, unless this coaching staff brings in an entirely new group of pitchers and several instant impact position players, which I guess not impossible. And I know with the pitching staff, you have Kendall Wilkie, who's now exhausted her eligibility, and also at senior weekend against USF, you had Maddie Boyd and Taylor Edwards honored. So that's a minimum right there of three new pitchers on staff. So I guess you have no choice but to make some additions there and make some additions in the lineup. But it's not necessarily easy to do. I'm not just hand-waving away that we can make all those additions in an offseason and become an NCAA caliber kind of team.
And I will say, I mean, as much as it's certainly your level of competition is going way up, you also now get to go out into the transfer portal and or the high school ranks and wherever else and go, hey, you want to come pitch? We have innings to offer in the Big 12 next year. Like that's you'd think a fairly reasonable carrot to dangle. So, you know, as much as we've seen this staff really not be able to bring in the requisite talent, you know, the last couple of years, if you can't bring in the requisite talent now when you've got Big 12 innings on offer, and, you know, on top of everything else, then that's when you know well and truly that they're just not capable of finding the pitching talent that Houston needs to be successful.
No doubt.
All right, Sam, so sticking with the bat and ball sports and moving on to one that's doing significantly better, our Cougar baseball team. Sam is just continuing to go out there and win every single conference series.
No doubt. We're going to lead off tonight talking about a busy past week that was a Silver Glove clinching series win over the Rice Owls at Recklay Park. First on deck here. Coming into this one, you have both U of H and Rice with a big series in the coming weekend. U of H would be fighting for first against Wichita State. Rice had a tough series in the road coming on the road against UTSA. You saw both teams use a combined 21 pitchers. Rice's Mark Perkins was the only guy who went longer than 2 1/3 innings. Cougs got the scoring going in this one. Kind of unlucky to only score two runs in the opening frame with Rice's starter walking three batters. Rice would immediately tie it with two of their own. The first, the game would really follow a very back-and-forth pattern from there. Cougs took a 4-2 lead in the fourth. Rice tied up the game in the fifth. Cougs took a 5-4 lead, which they were able to actually extend to the bottom of the ninth, but Rice was able to eventually tie the game after opening the game with back-to-back singles, eventually was able to get one of those runners home on a fielder's choice. And then the extra innings, you saw both teams cool down a bit. And I mentioned him a bit ago, Rice's Mark Perkins, I think was the only Owl pitcher to really solve the Cougar lineup for an extended period of time, had a season high for him, 4 scoreless innings. Rice eventually did have to go to their bullpen again. The Cougs would finally get to a Rice pitcher in the 12th inning, thanks to a Justin Murray RBI single. Cougars would extend the lead further with another ribby from Cam Nickens. Murray would also, one of my favorite recent baseball plays, would steal home on a Rice attempted pickoff at first, put the Cougars up 8-5, where the score would ultimately stay. Wanted to also shout out Kerry Arboleda, got that 12th inning Cougar rally going with a pinch hit walk, gave the Cougars what felt like at the time the first runner in ages, and allowed the Cougars to get that rally going to win this game. Owen Woodward came on, finished the game off in the bottom half, the 12th, worked around a leadoff double to strike out the next three Owl batters to get his fourth save of the year and give the Cougars a second straight Silver Glove Series win. Was also on the mound, shout out, two-plus innings of scoreless relief. You got different points in this one from Dan Wright and Kyle Ayers. That has been the case often this year. Cougars defense also really helped them this one. 4 Owl errors, the Cougs 0. So no matter the state of Rice baseball, always great to get a Silver Glove Series win for the Cougs.
Yeah, we love that. And as much as you know, Houston is kind of, even though the last few years have been disappointing from a baseball perspective, Houston, the overall trajectory for the last decade or so has definitely been Houston catching and surpassing Rice, or at least Rice falling to Houston's level as Houston has been mostly heading in the opposite direction. So always good to see, to not only win, but to retain the Silver Glove for the second consecutive year. And like I said, to get to go to their place and not even have to worry about needing the game to clinch the Silver Glove.
No doubt. And of course, the Cougs had a big series this past weekend against the Wichita State Shockers. And really, other than Sunday's game not getting played due to inclement weather, I don't know if you could have scripted a better weekend series for the Cougs in a pivotal head-to-head series with first place control in the American on the line. And the Friday game was a bit of deja vu from the last time he played Wichita State. The Cougs, once again, really struggled at the start to figure out the Shockers' starting pitcher, Clark Candiotti. And when these two teams first met, the Shockers got their lone win from the first series in a game that Candiotti started and threw 6 2/3 innings of scoreless ball. Cougars did not get their first hit this one until the fifth inning when Brandon Hughes smacked a double, was ultimately brought home by Malachi Lott later in the inning to tie the game at one. And I thought Josh Ektis, the Cougars starting pitcher, as he's really often done in some of the bigger conference games this year, gave the Cougs a strong effort. He pitched into the seventh inning, kept the game close as Cougar hitters did have their initial struggles with Candiotti. Did ultimately one of the Shocker hitters make Ektis pay in the final batter of his night with a two-run homer, put the visitors up temporarily 3-1 in the seventh. But Cougars did finally get something going off Candiotti in the eighth inning. He was pulled after back-to-back Cougars reached to start the inning, and Nate Sneed, the Shocker reliever, ended up inheriting runners in the corners. And no outs, Cougs would ultimately tie the game on an Alex Lopez RBI single. Two outs in the game tied, as he has done quite often this year. Justin Murray came up in the clutch with an RBI single, put the Cougars ahead 4-3. Murray would later score off of some poor Shocker defense, a failed pickoff at first base that was thrown away into the outfield, getting the insurance run, but Murray would need it, took the mound in the ninth inning for a scoreless frame, got the save, and allowed the Cougars to be in the driver's seat for the Saturday game. Really, like the Rice game, this one, I think, demonstrated how valuable it is that this Cougar team can rely on their fielding so much, and definitely the Shocker's undoing came from, I think, some poor fielding in that decisive eighth inning. Cougars would clinch the series on Saturday night with a win over the Shockers in a game that followed, I think, a bit of a different script than the opener on Friday, whereas you saw the Cougar hitters struggle against Candiotti last time out. Really not so similar struggles against Saturday's pitcher for the Shockers, Peyton Tolley. Cougars got at least one runner home in four of the five innings that Tolley pitched on Saturday. Shockers did take an early 2-1 lead in this one, but Cougars would retake the lead for good in the bottom half of the second with a clutch two-out, two RBI double from Drew Bianco, who two innings later would hit another two RBI extra base hit, this time tripling home Brandon Burkle and Kerry Arboleda to put the Cougars ahead 5-2. It wasn't just at the plate. Bianco really played some outstanding defense in center field on Saturday. Never going to be among your best hitters, but definitely a guy whose hitting has been trending up. And there have been a number of times now where he's hit well in the nine hole, which could be so, so valuable setting the table for your 1-2-3 in addition to playing a premium defensive position as well as he has. It's kind of like Ian McMillan at shortstop. You shouldn't expect them to carry your lineup, but they could be so, so valuable when they are getting hits, and they can get big hits. So they're going to do so much for you in addition to just being everyday lineup guys, maybe not your best hitters, but they're going to save some runs for you like we saw Bianco do on Saturday night. Zach Arnold also grabbed a really nice line drive in this one that would have been extra base hits, and certainly a guy, Zach Arnold, who is holding his own at the plate and in the field. Cameron Nickens will put the Cougs up subsequently 7-2, and I thought Kyle Ayers gave the Cougs really valuable 5+ innings of relief kind of in the middle of this one. Max Miller did a good job settling things down when the Shockers did finally get to Ayers a bit in the eighth inning and gave the Cougs that 7-4 cushion. Shockers did make it a bit interesting, and I think had the tying run at the plate in the bottom of the ninth, cutting the lead to 7-5, but Cougars would find a way to get a fly out there late and clinch a series win on Saturday night. Shout out to Brandon Burkle and Drew Bianco at the bottom of the lineup, who both had multiple hits. Murray and Cameron Nickens obviously were big contributors to the plate with multiple hits as well.
Yeah, I think the Cougars did everything under their control. The only things that didn't go well were the things that were completely outside of their control, such as Mother Nature preventing the third game from being played, and East Carolina sweeping all three games of their weekend series. So despite having not lost any conference games, Houston still lost half a ground's worth in the AAC title race to East Carolina, while obviously you know, importantly, putting two games between themselves and Wichita, who would come into the series tied with them for first place in conference play. But Houston still half a game up over East Carolina, 12-5 to the Pirates, 12-6 for first place, with now two series left in the regular season. The first one is going to be Houston traveling to face Tulane on the road this weekend. The Cougs with their final three road games of the season coming up in New Orleans here. And, you know, outside of the logjam at the top of the conference with the three schools we're talking about, Houston, ECU, and Wichita, everybody else in the American currently has a record between 8-10 and 6-12. And the Greenies fall right in the middle of that at 7-11. After the series, Houston will head to Constellation Field in Sugarland on Tuesday for the rubber match of the Don Sanders Cup before hosting Cincinnati to close out the regular season. But let's not jump ahead of Tulane here. The Green Wave having a rough go of it this year, just 14-34 overall with the aforementioned 7-11 conference record. They've dropped five straight series in American Athletic Conference play after beating Memphis 2-3. To open things. And if you're thinking maybe Tulane's a little bit tougher at home, nope, just 8-17 within the friendly confines of Greer Field at Turchin Stadium. And, you know, kind of set my first thought looking at the numbers on the year for Tulane is that they look like kind of a poor man's version of the Cougars. You know, they hit pretty decent, you know, nice pop in the lineup. Simon Baumgart and Teo Banks, both guys who had been in the program for a couple of years now. They're both having breakout years with the bats, both have double-digit homers. They just can't really pitch worth crap is kind of the problem. They've got two starters with mid-4 ERAs. Their next best ERA from any pitcher who's thrown more than an inning is 5.34. You know, and they strike out enough guys. They average as a staff over a strikeout an inning, but they just put a bunch of guys on for free, and they're just giving up a bunch of hard contact. And while Houston has won exactly two games in every conference weekend series, Tulane has lost exactly two games in, like I said, other than the first one against Memphis, every subsequent AAC series. So, kind of just like a looking at a lesser version of themselves, of, you know, Houston looking at a lesser version of itself. I guess the only thing that scares me at this point is that it makes almost too much sense for Houston to win 2 out of 3 here, since they keep doing that and Tulane keeps losing 2 out of 3. It makes too much sense, which means that maybe it can't happen that way. So that scares me a little bit, just kind of the that very superstitious aspect of it. And the fact that, you know, Houston could win 2 out of 3, have won every single conference weekend series, and they could still go into the final weekend half a game back, because if ECU sweeps them again, then the Cougs will be half a game back and have no way to make up the last game. So, like I said, some things outside of Houston's control, but in terms of, you know, what they can control, they're facing a Tulane team that it seems like the Cougars, if they continue to play well, should be able to get at least a series win, even playing on the road, Sam.
No doubt. Definitely a team that's hit for power real well. I mean, 65 home runs in 48 games is loud. 5 different lineup regulars with 9 or more dingers. And I will point out, Dylan Carmouche and Ricky Castro, those two weekend stars with mid-4 ERAs that you mentioned, have had some good performances lately. I'd say Castro in particular, through a complete game shutout against ECU and the Green Waves, a surprise win over the Pirates last weekend, through 6 innings and allowed 2 runs in a Green Wave win over UCF. And that Tulane staff has done a good job missing bats. They're 42nd in Division I in Ks per 9 innings, but they haven't done a whole lot else well, like you said. We're talking about a team ERA just under 7 outside of Carmouche and Castro. No regularly featuring pitcher with an ERA under 5.34. And a lineup that, for that, I think, really impressive power, has really struggled to hit for average, which maybe somewhat negates those good power numbers. I think you kind of see that borne out in game-by-game results, which are kind of wildly up and down. Like, you'll see some really good performances from the bats, but you'll also see some games where Tulane's kind of stuck in the 2 or 3 run range. Worth noting, like you said, they have not been swept in conference play this year, have not been swept at home by anyone, conference or non-conference, at all. So a sweep would be nice here to keep pace with ECU and allow the Cougars maybe a little less heartburn down the stretch, but Tulane hasn't had that done to them this year, so kind of easier said than done there. I think the goal is, it's always been this weekend, 2 of 3.
All right, and then another sport with some significant action coming up in the near future, Cougar Track and Field heading to AAC Outdoor Championships here. And, you know, I think very interesting, kind of different vibes for both programs, the men's and the women's team, that is, on the men's side. you know, you've got them heading to Tampa and AAC championships, looking to get back to their conference title winning ways. And we know that this program was kind of, you know, dominant and won, was getting very used to just winning, both, you know, indoor and outdoor championships of the American. That's just kind of a matter of course. And now they've lost two in a row with Wichita taking outdoor championships last year and then Cincinnati taking indoors earlier this year. And then on the women's side, you saw a program that could get to the top of the AAC pile and did on a number of occasions, but now has just seen UCF pass them and really become kind of the class of the conference. And, you know, I think kind of we'll talk about some individuals here, but looking at kind of the overview, Sam, of the conference, my feel is that UCF probably still gonna run things on the women's side, but I like Houston shot on the men's side. And Sam, I know we don't make a lot of bold predictions here, but I am gonna go out on a limb and say Houston is winning the dang thing. They're gonna win the American Athletic Conference title outdoors here, coming up on the men's side. I really like what the Cougs have going here, but I think a lot of individuals on both the men's and the women's team that are gonna be in top competition and competing for conference titles.
And big picture, I think my hope is that the men's team obviously end their time in the American on a high note with a win, maybe set some personal bests before NCAA West prelims. And I think a bit different on the women's side is just be more competitive with UCF than last year's conference outdoor meet. And I think, of course, like the men, put as many athletes as possible in position to maybe move on to the latter parts of the season. And I'm not trying to be a defeatist here to the women, but UCF, really, you go look down the performance list, they have a lot of top-end performers and a lot of depth. I think maybe most importantly, just makes them such a difficult opponent. Really worth reviewing your top men's and women's individual and relay performers. Sean Meswagnani in the 100 and 200, top 25, top 5 in the 100, top 25 in both the 100 and 200. De'Avion Wilson, currently 6th in the 110 hurdles. DJ Akindele just behind Wilson, tied for 12th. For best time in the country in the 110 hurdles. Not sure if they'll run both hurdle events, but just worth noting, Wilson and Akindele also both have the top AAC times in the 400 hurdles as well. Christian Sampi, 8th nationally in the pole vault, last outdoor championship. I feel like Sampi is one of the athletes who maybe underperformed their general best season performance in that meet. Would be nice for the Cougars to capture the top spot in the pole vault. Benjamin Okafor, also has the top AAC performance in the long jump. I believe Quentin Stringfellow, the defending champion, the triple jump as well. And of course, with the men in H-Town Speed City, we're talking about the 4x1 relay. The Cougars have the 8th fastest time in the country. Also, maybe a bit lower on the timing charts, but the Cougs have the 2 fastest 4x4 relay times among AAC programs as well. I think the formula on the men's side is pretty simple. You know that Wichita State and Tulsa are going to pile up points in the decathlon, the distance, some of the throwing and field events. I think this group just needs to be really consistent in those sprint or hurdle or relay or even some field events where U of H has a proven standout athlete. On the women's side, you have Cecilia Tamayo-Garza, who's top 25 nationally in both the 100 and 200. Priscilla Dejakun, who has the second best throw this year in the hammer, second behind Memphis's Amber Simpson. Also, Destiny Smith and Sydney Townsend are both have the second best AAC times in the 100 and 400 hurdles, respectively. The Cougar women should be good for second in the 4x1 and 4x4 behind UCF. Also, Nuala Sala, Tui Lefano, one to watch in the shot put with the Deja Kun as part of the throw squad. So keeping my expectations realistic, but...
Yeah, I think when you look at, you know, Houston having, you know, not completely on the men's side, not the maybe the peak sprinting depth that we've seen from them, but still you see, you know, Sean Meswagnani being the favorite in the 100 and the 200. You know, Houston has 5 of the top 9 individuals in the conference this year in outdoors. In the 100, they got 5 of the top 8 in the 200. Even some events where you have, you know, athletes that you maybe aren't expecting to, you know, qualify for nationals and be a force, but still they are the, you know, thus far top times in the American. I'm thinking about like Trey Johnson in the 400, Lloyd Frylot in the 800, guys who are you know, heading in as the favorites. You know, Christian Sampi certainly in the pole vault, although he's someone that is definitely more of a national noisemaker. You mentioned Wilson and Akindele. You know, they're 1-2 in the 110 hurdles. They're 2-3 in the 400 hurdles in terms of top times. You know, Ben Okafor and Aaron Davis, 1-2 in the long jump. Houston has 3 of the top 5 in the triple jump. Houston's massive, massive favorites in both the 4x1 and 4x4 relays. So a lot of events you expect Houston to not only do well, but actually win at. You know, and you've got, you know, Wichita, Cincinnati, Tulsa all have multiple events that they're strong in. Some of those are events that the Cougs don't really, you know, compete in, so they can't really. There's some of it is not really up to you, right? You want to see all those other programs split all those points as evenly as possible, so that no one is really dominating, because you can't really, you know. Houston's not going to do much in the steeplechase or in the 5,000 or things like that. So you just got to kind of hope that everything else splits a little bit in a way that is beneficial to you. And certainly Houston's title, not a foregone conclusion, but not backing down. I am predicting Houston has enough to get it done here on the men's side. And like I said, on the women's side, UCF's going to take it. I think that's probably comfortable. But like you said, Cecilia Tamayo Garza against some really stacked, mostly otherwise UCF-based competition, and both the 100 and the 200 meters, both very deep, very talented fields that, you know, Tamayo Garza is ranked number 2 and number 1 respectively in. So should be a couple of really fun events. Tui Lafano and Daisy Mone, two of the top 3 contenders in the shot put. Adeja Kun, like you mentioned, part of that really high-ranked affair with Amber Simpson. They should be 1-2 in some order in the hammer throw. You mentioned Destiny Smith and Sydney Townsend in the hurdles. Destiny Lawrence in the triple jump, I believe, will be on the podium for the Cougs. And the Cougs, you know, it's going to be hard to top UCF in either the relays, but Houston should be, you know, 2 or 3 in both of those relays, I think. So, you know, a lot to like on the women's side in terms of hopefully competing as a reasonably close second there. And then just, you know, I think lots of athletes on both the men's and the women's teams. They're going to be heading to NCAA prelims in a couple of weeks as well. So not only seeing athletes here trying to, you know, win conference titles and conference hardware, but also trying to position themselves well for prelims in a couple of weeks. So very excited about the program. I feel like, you know, it's a program that is still has some juice to it and is maybe kind of rebounding and is going to, I think, have a strong outdoor season. We've seen the men team, you know, ranked in the top 25 for much of this outdoor season. So excited about where this program is going still. And hopefully we got a couple more of exciting weeks from our track program here.
I think one last thought with the women. I think this year I want to see an event win, because the Cougars have not gotten an American Conference individual win since 2021.
All right, you got a shot to call. What's your shot? Who's winning an event, Sam?
Ooh, it's a good one. There's a couple of good ones here. I'm gonna go with Priscilla Deja Kun in the hammer throw, upsetting Amber Simpson to get that title.
I like it. I got Cecilia Tamayo Garza beating all those UCF athletes in the 200 to take the individual title. There's my shot. Hopefully,
I like it. That was my other pick. If I was gonna pick one.
All right, so looking forward to that, and moving to some off-season sports here. Cougar football notably added, as we've now actually talked about, all 3 in-season sports: men's golf, baseball, and men's women's track and field. So that is all. Those are the only sports that are still competing in AAC play in any form or fashion, or as AAC teams. Everyone else moving on to the Big 12, and Cougar football certainly trying to do that. Has made a trio of additions since our last episode in Cooper Hamilton, David Ndukwe, and Aubrey Smith, taking them in reverse order of commitment date. Cooper Hamilton, kicker who comes from Division II Eastern New Mexico, didn't get a ton of field goal attempts last year, but was 9-13 with a couple of long bombs. Was looked like about 50% at getting touchbacks on kickoffs. So maybe a kickoff specialist remains to be determined, but kind of, you know, effectively replaces outgoing kicker Kyle Ramsey, who hit the transfer portal in the other direction. So obviously we'll see how it shakes out with Cooper Hamilton and Alabama transfer Jack Martin at the kicker position, Sam.
Yeah, I think digging deeper on that 9-13, I thought it was impressive that 2 of those 9 makes were from beyond 45 yards, which I think at least shows some leg on his part. And this is the one position where you don't have to really factor in the jump in competition from Division 2 up to playing in the Big 12 Conference next year, unless I guess D2 has secretly been playing with a different size football this whole time and never noticed. But in all seriousness, I think it gives you another guy to compete with Bama transfer Jack Martin, which is a positive, definitely.
And then David Ndukwe, an offensive lineman, transfers in from Western Kentucky. And I think the best thing you can say about Ndukwe, Sam, is that he is in his 4th year of college eligibility now this fall, and will still be a sophomore by his eligibility clock, because he played in the 2020 season and played just 1 game, took a red shirt last year. But, you know, in 3 years with the Hilltoppers, who are, you know, to be fair, a pretty good team, didn't make any starts, and as far as I can tell, was kind of an intentional healthy red shirt this past year, Sam. Maybe unless I missed something and he was injured. But yeah, I think either way, probably someone you're not hopefully depending on to fill a big role this year. But we've talked about Houston just needs some bodies on the offensive line. He gives you that as a 4th-year college guy, and then maybe in 2 or 3 years, maybe he'll be someone that you're maybe a little bit more comfortable with playing a bigger role on the line.
I think what intrigues me the most about Ndoukwe is that this is a guy who entered the Western Kentucky program as a 6'6", 240 listed defensive lineman, that he has been able in these past three seasons to put on the weight necessary to kind of look like a college offensive lineman, that he has the frame to, you know, eventually develop into that kind of guy. And it's not nothing that he played a decent amount on special teams his first 2 years in the Hilltopper program, that he was a promising enough athlete to get on the field the first 2 years playing in this position, which isn't a given, especially at the offensive line, for guys making that move from high school to the Division I level. Again, that he's been able to add the weight and muscle to his frame necessary to make that position switch, I think that's kind of the projectable, intriguing thing with Ndoukwe. But I would say it's also fair to add that ideally here, U of H's offensive line in the coming season is such that Ndoukwe isn't thrust into starting action or anything other than kind of backup action. And offensive line is one of those positions with a much longer development cycle than, I don't know, maybe receiver or running back or defensive back, where 3 or 4 years in, I feel like you kind of have a good idea at one of those aforementioned positions, like what a guy is, whereas you need sometimes 4 or 5, I guess with COVID, eligibility, 6 years to really see offensive linemen develop sometimes. We'll say it feels like you had a number of guys in your program recently that probably have been a decent comp to Ndoukwe, which sure seemed like they were told to maybe go find another program. So it means now you have, with the guys projected to come in the program, including Ndoukwe, 13 offensive line bodies plus some walk-ons, which is closer to ideal numbers, but probably 3 or 4 short of what you would really want going into the start of next season.
Didn't realize he was on the Cam Elliff position switch from defensive to offensive line there. But then finally, the Cougars added Aubrey Smith, a linebacker from Colorado. It was a pretty good recruiting get for the Buffs last year. A 4-star recruit, according to ESPN, played in 11 games as a true freshman this past year. Not a ton of action, though, just 8 tackles total. So, you know, someone I think that would be kind of like Ndoukwe, I'd be surprised if he's playing major snaps this coming year. But, you know, you've got some seniors graduating there this year. So maybe in a year or two, I think Aubrey Smith is seeing a little bit more of the field. And you know, I think if like I said, if we've been adding him as a freshman, we've been excited about him as a recruit. And then the fact that, you know, he even played some as a true freshman, I think gives me reason to believe that this could be a positive down the line at some point, if maybe not in 2023.
One of the, I believe, 70-something players who have not returned to the Colorado program under head coach Deion Sanders. But like you said, a good recruiting get for that last Colorado staff. I think you don't put the fact that he was on a pretty terrible Colorado team in 2022 on him as a true freshman. I think noteworthy that he was able to get on the field. Didn't play a ton, but was able to get on the field for 11 of the Buffs' 12 games last year. And like, kind of add on to what you said, if he had been a part of your high school recruiting class in 2022, the only high school guys ranked ahead of him, at least according to 247 Sports, would have been Matthew Gold and Pancake Hunter, which I would say is pretty good company for the young man.
All right, and while we're talking about football, Sam, I know you wanted to give a shout-out to one of our favorite recent Cougar defensive linemen.
I sure do. DeAnthony Jones, who I mentioned in the solo episode briefly as getting an invite to the Chicago Bears rookie minicamp, went to said minicamp and was subsequently signed by the Bears to be a part of their 90-man training camp roster, potentially go further and go through all the process to try to make their roster during the preseason. I think really great news, though. I think we're probably both of the opinion that Jones should have just gotten an undrafted free agent deal immediately after, like some of his recent former Cougar teammates did. But I also think this is a guy who really thrives when he's counted out and has that ability to rush the passer, one of those really valuable skills that can keep you playing professional football at some level for a while. I have not done a hugely deep dive on the Bears roster, but I've seen from cursory research that pass rushing was one of that team's biggest needs. So hopefully that bodes well for one of our more favorite recent U of H players' ability to stick around with this NFL organization or the 31 others out there.
All right, Sam. Also, while we're still talking football, I told you before we got started that I was going to ask you a question off the cuff, but listeners, I swear Sam has not heard this question before. This is me surprising him. So recently, since our last episode, a couple of bookmakers came out with over-under win totals for the college football season and have Houston pegged at 4.5. And Sam, I saw on Twitter that you said you were taking the over on Houston 4.5 wins. So I assume, I'm going to take a wild assumption here, that Rice and Sam Houston are two of the wins that are going to get Houston to at least 5 wins here. So what are your other 3 wins for the Houston Cougar football program this year?
Putting me on the spot here. Yes, you were correct in your assumption. Rice and Sam Houston are two of the wins I'm counting towards that total to go over 4.5. I also have, not that I think this is going to be easy, but I do believe the Cougars can beat UTSA at home in week 1. I'm counting that as one of them. And it gets a little tougher looking at the Big 12 schedule. The one that immediately jumps out at me, the one I feel fairly confident the Cougars are going to win, I'm going to say West Virginia, certainly my highest confidence level game for the season. That gets us to 4 wins. And vamp and look at the 2023 Houston Cougar football schedule. I'm going to say it's senior day. Oklahoma State, I believe that is going to be your 5th win this year. And I feel like right now that's my general season prediction, that Cougars go 5-7 and we just barely clear that 4.5 total that you were referencing.
All right. I take it at this point. I do not have a whole lot of confidence that Houston is going to hit the over on that 4.5. If I was looking out for some preseason, but then again, last year I think I did like 3 or 4 over under placed a couple of M&Ms on a couple of wagers over under win totals, and I think I only one of them maybe paid back. So the fact that I see us maybe a little might take the under if I had to take one, and my life depended on it. But apparently I'm terrible at these bets, so maybe that's a good thing for Cougar football.
Just want to point out here, nothing we're saying here should constitute any kind of betting advice for the general public. But I will also point out that in my placing of M&Ms on various college football outcomes, not to brag, but season win totals were the highest profit ever placed putting M&Ms on college football topics. So just point that out.
Well, there you go. And then finally, before we go, just want to, speaking of shouting out some former Cougs, as we did with D'Anthony Jones a minute ago, wanted to give a big old shout out to Quentin Grimes. Big performance by him last night. The Knicks were trailing the Heat 3-1 in the second round of the NBA playoffs, Eastern Conference playoffs last night. Quentin Grimes plays all 48 minutes of that elimination game for the Knicks, does a little bit of everything. 8 points, 5 assists, 4 rebounds, 2 steals, 2 blocks. Had this big highlight reel play, late on in the game. The Knicks kind of clinging to, I think it was like a 5-point lead in the last couple of minutes. Grimes takes a really hard screen on defense, goes down. The kind of play that if it's early in the game, you see them blow the whistle to let him get out, but Miami not going easy on him, keeps the play alive. He's able to get up, get back, clearly hurt, get back into the play, and manages to get his hands on the ball and steals it while fighting off an injury, essentially, to basically clinch the game for the Knicks. Got all kinds of for praise, from Knicks fans and NBA sources online. So really excited to see him making a name for himself at the pro level. And, As someone who's a big Michael Jordan fan as a kid, never thought I'd find myself cheering for the Knicks, I gotta say, but really, really excited to see Q doing well, and hopefully he can help them keep their season going even a little bit further.
Believe me, as somebody who's one of his earliest formative sports memories is the 1994 Rockets-Kings Finals, weird for me to be so excited about a Kings win here as well. Just a reminder of what a jaw-droppingly talented and smart basketball player Quentin Grimes is, in addition to being a really tough basketball player, which is kind of one of those prerequisites to be in this Cougar program. And this is a program with a great recent past, the Cougar men's basketball, and a great promising future. But I think not a cheap shot to anyone to say that Quentin Grimes is absolutely one of the most talented players that we all had the privilege of witnessing his 2 years in that program, that he is a positive contributing starting player on a playoff NBA team, I don't think really is a surprise to any Cougar fan watching.
All right. Well, talking about Quentin Grimes going off is, I think, about as good of a point to end the podcast on as we're going to get. So we'll go ahead and do that right there. I do want to mention on our way out, of course, would love for you to support the Scott Hohn podcast if you're enjoying the work that Sam and I do on a regular basis by going to patreon.com/SH podcast for as little as $5 a month. You can both support Sam and I and the work that we do on a regular basis to bring you the latest and greatest Cougar news. And you can also get access to bonus content that is only available to our Patreon supporters. Do want to also encourage you to support us by leaving a 5-star review in your app of choice, by following the 1012 Network on social media, and by going to homefieldapparel.com and using promo code HOLMAN12 to get 15% off of your first order. If you want to say hi, you can also reach out, email us, shpodcast@gmail.com, or tweet at us at shpodcast. That's it for us. If you made it all the way to the end, you are awesome. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap.